to start off with, you had to kind of see what your business looked like from the customer's eyes. What are they going to do first? They're going to Google shoe repair near me. And if my page pops up and I don't have any kind of information, you know, you're probably not going to look. But if my page pops up and I got tons of pictures and examples of my work and reviews, then people will probably gravitate more towards that. And then they did.
ShoeCast! Welcome to the Stitch Down ShoeCast, where we talk quality footwear, how it's made, and all the things we love about it. I'm Ben from StitchDown.com, and today I am exhilarated to chat with Tony Wyatt and Tobias Krislip of Wyatt and Dagg Cobbler Company in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and also Charlotte, North Carolina, and also a really old cabin somewhere. Honestly, you can't even find it on Google, I think. So they're everywhere, basically, in the region. Tony is one of the OG all-time greats in the cobbling game, and Tobias is no joke himself, building out a specialty mail-in repair and restoration business over the last few years. We're going to talk about that, why every single cobbler is now legally required to have a YouTube channel, how things have changed in the cobbling world over the last few decades, and where they see it going, and plenty more. But first, I need to give a tender ShoeCast shout-out to our sponsor this week, Standard & Strange. Clinch Boots, Rolling Dub Trio, Attractions, The Realist of McCoy's, John Lofgren, Wesco, they've got it all, along with some of the best made and honestly just dope clothing in the whole world. Check it all out at standardandstrange.com. If you find yourself randomly shouting ShoeCast throughout the day at work, probably time you became a member of the Stitchdown Premium community we've been building for almost 5 years now. The STP Discord is just a rollicking time full of incredible people with incredible knowledge, and your membership is by far the best way to support this podcast and ensure that the conversations with the most interesting people in the footwear world continue apace. We're coming up on 100 episodes, which is pretty bonkers, and your support will ensure that we can get to 100,000 more episodes, which you want. More info on SDP at stitchdown.com. Finally, do not forget about Bootcamp 2, a celebration of shoemaking in Industry City, Brooklyn, October 12th and 13th, 2024. Tobias came last year. You need to come this year. Save that date and do whatever you need to get to NYC this October. We'll see you there and in the Discord. All right, let's do this. Tony Wyatt, and Tobias Krislip, welcome to the ShoeCast. How's everything? What are you guys wearing on your feet today?
Hey, Ben, how's it going, man? I've got on Bordones. They're a really good boot. It's handmade, and they sent them in for me to give a try and check them out. We're going to rip them apart here really soon and do a video on how they're constructed and everything.
Nice. I had a pair that didn't quite fit me, like an early pair. I was impressed, man, from what I have seen and heard. They're only getting better.
Yeah, actually, that's what I'm wearing as well. They're my Patina Thunderdome pair, actually. I'm wearing them for that. I have the cap toe. It's one of the earlier models. I know they've made some improvements to it, but I'm loving the boots.
Nice work. I'm glad everybody's wearing boots. It doesn't always happen on the show. I like posted a stat in the Discord yesterday about Crocs, and like they had like their earnings report, and it was absolutely staggering how many even more Crocs they're selling. And then, yeah, half the times we get people on here who are like making, you know, some of the world's greatest shoes or repairing them by hand. And here they are wearing foam with holes and little kind of dangly things. So great work to you. I'm thrilled about this.
Yeah, it's one of the things with us is that we're also boot enthusiasts. So it works out pretty well.
My brother is a pedorthist, and he argues that Crocs are one of the worst things you can possibly put on your feet.
Okay, get specific.
The way you stand, the way your foot needs support, different things like that. If you're barefoot, it's better for you than being in a real soft cushion, because anything that you put improper pressure against with cushion is going to just enhance that. Like if your heel bone rotates outward, technical terminology would be calcaneus everts, then you're going to sink into a cushion, creating more eversion, causing it to the heel bone to rotate further out. People think it feels good because when they first put them on, they feel soft. But if you try standing in one spot all day in a nice, good, rugged boot, that is very supportive versus a cushioned shoe, you're going to be a lot more fatigued at the end of the day in anything with cushions in it.
Crocs are bad. Perfect. Yeah. Wait, Tony, I don't think I realized that that's what your brother does as a podorthist. Is that something that influences the work you do and the understanding that you have of shoes? Because you just threw around some highly technical terminology. That was great.
Yeah, actually, it did form a lot of our direction that we took our company in. Back in 83, I laid a motorcycle down at 120 miles an hour and tore my foot up really good. So for about 12 years, I walked with a very bad problem. I had been to other podorthists, and the only solution for my problem was an operation. I was not going to go there because in the shoe repair industry, we see all foot-related issues. People come in, my feet are killing me. I had this operation done, and now the problem's worse, or scar tissue bothers me. So I didn't want any of that. So my brother, he was a nuke in the Navy. I was an architect via schooling, and my dad was a mechanical engineer. We just looked at the foot as a machine and invented a product, and we have a patent on it and everything. But during the process of inventing it, my brother got interested in the field and became a podorthist. And so that changed the direction of our business, because then we started looking at trying to make footwear more conducive for people to wear and be able to be more comfortable in life, not continuously deal with their foot-related problems. That's one reason why we sell our recrafts the way we do, is because, you know, I'm discussing with the customers how it relates to their foot, what job they're doing, how much they weigh. If they have any kind of a gait problem, I assess all of that to advise them on what's the better way to recraft. Like, no, that sole is horrible for you. You don't want that sole because it's going to go against what you're using it for.
Oh, man, it's the Lord's work. So on their weight, do you add like 5 pounds to what they tell you? Do you add 20 pounds to?
I let them decide what they're going to tell me. So I just go by that.
Wait, so what's the product, the patented product?
The product is called Alpha. My nephew took over the company. He and his partner market it. And honestly, I don't know the website address, but the old website address is wyfield.com, wyfield.com. It's a really cool product. It's an orthosis that's designed to fit in shoes instead of make you change size of shoes that you wear. The design is actually what we have a patent on, whereas a lot of orthoses in the patent world, their patent is based on their material. It exercises the foot muscles in your foot as you're standing, and as you're wearing it, your feet get healthier over time, just like any other exercise helps you get healthier.
Man, I love it.
It's now footmedicinsoles.com.
There you go.
I found it. Yeah, you can get napalm orange, which is now healthy for you. About time. So Tobias, you are not in a old cabin full of holes.
Not in this current moment. No, the Wi-Fi there is not great.
So what's the deal with that? And Tony, Tobias was causing problems around the shop, so you shipped him off to a remote cabin.
I got him as far away from me as I possibly could.
He still comes and visits me every week.
Unfortunately, it's a downfall of my job.
Isn't that sweet?
I started working for them kind of part-time. I met Tony's son, Lance Wyatt, actually riding motorcycles. And I started to come by the shop and just waiting for him to get off work so that we could go ride. And it ended up being, I would just kind of hang out. I got to meet the rest of the family and everything. They invited me to have a part-time job there. So I started shining shoes and learning little things after hours. The training process was great. Tony would train me after hours, and he'd come and he'd show me one thing and then go take a nap until I got that one thing done, and I'd come tell him, wake him up. So it was great. Your new boss is sleeping. You have to have the courage to go wake him up. So that started our relationship off great. But I worked for out of that shop, our Winston-Salem shop, for a good while, say 4 or 5 years, until an opportunity came up for us to open up another location towards Raleigh in Durham, North Carolina. So they approached me with that. So I went there. I ran the shop there for a good 7 years. And in that meantime, we opened up our Charlotte location. We stretched out and expanded a bit, which was really nice. Let's say 7 years of working in that shop. I trained some people. I had some employees. It was really nice. The way the direction was going, you know, I was getting more shoes in the mail eventually than I was walking in my door. So it was hard for us to really kind of justify paying the high retail space rent. This opportunity with this cabin came up. It was a tough decision to make to shut down the brick and mortar location, but so far it's been pretty good.
And that's where you're operating out of, and people are mailing stuff in. Eventually they make their way to the cabin, and Tony unfortunately has to see you. And that's pretty much what's going on there. And you're just like out in the middle of nowhere in solitude fixing shoes.
Yeah, that's it.
A little funny story about the cabin. We shot a video. It's our Whiskey Iron Ranger video. My nephew Nick and Tobias went out to the cabin and used it as a starting point for the video.
Just a prop at that point.
Yeah, because it was just a storage cabin. So he walks in the door, and then, you know, with editing, it pops and he's inside of our studio that we had built in the back of our Winston-Salem store to get our YouTube channel up and going. From there, it kind of became a dream to Tobias to have a shop in a cabin like that. It was like, man, that would be so cool. And then a couple of years later, he ends up buying the property that the cabin is on. And now it's his cabin, and he has his shop in the cabin that he used as a prop one day.
You guys are giving away all your secrets here. Let's back it up even further. Tony, like, how did this all start for you personally and the business and all that? I mean, because the business is what, 35 years old at this point?
Brother Ricky is the founder of the company. He started in high school. Our father was a minister, and one of the members of my dad's church owned a shoe shop in Hamlet, North Carolina. He worked through high school doing that. When he got out of the Navy, he was like, yeah, I don't want to have three-headed babies. I know enough about nuclear power that it's just not a good thing. So I just graduated high school. I moved to Raleigh and met my brother there. He was out looking for a job, and a shoe shop had a help wanted sign. So he walked in. He said, hey, yeah, I just want to check, see what you are looking for. The guy said, what do you know? And he told him what he had learned how to do in high school. And the guy said, put your apron on. You're late for work. within a couple of weeks, the guy took him out of the shop where he was at and put him running his own store in Cary, North Carolina. He ran that for several years for him, and then eventually met the woman that he married and had his kids with, and he moved to where she lived, and he worked for the shop that we now currently own. So when that guy was ready to retire, he bought it in 1990. In 1991, I came up and joined in with him, and he taught me how to fix shoes. I had worked for a company where I was started out as the first employee, and I'd helped them grow into three different cities and a couple hundred employees. We wanted to design and build our own business. So our goal was to build a chain of shoe repair shops. So the way we got our name was we had read an article in the Shoe Service Magazine, which was the industry's information highway back in those days. That article said that if you're creating a name, you want to, one, have a catchy name, and two, let people know you're a family-owned business. And so my brother came up with the idea. He said, well, hey, we're bringing our dad into the business. Our dad was retiring from the ministry, and so we taught our dad how to fix shoes. And everybody's something in son, let's be something in dad. And so Wyatt and Dad is how we came up with that name. And it worked. It worked great for years. We were known as Something and Dad. Nobody knew Wyatt, but they knew it was Something and Dad. And eventually the Wyatt started catching on, and people started to remember the Wyatt part.
It's terrible for me because everyone just automatically assumes he's my dad.
Yeah. He's like, no, no, no. Not at all.
It doesn't get much folksier than and dad. So yeah, we got dad here too. Wait, so how, your dad was how old? And he was like just picking this up and like you were just working him hard?
Yeah, our dad was in his late 50s when he retired from the ministry and came in, and my brother and myself taught him how to fix shoes. And then we bought a store in Wilson, North Carolina, and he took it over. And then we added a store in Lexington, North Carolina. Then we added another one in Winston-Salem. And we had one in Banner Elk. And then we had several other little small locations throughout Winston that we were operating and adding to our locations and everything. But not all of them took off good enough to really be full-fledged stores. But we were doing it. And then it was time for our dad to retire. He had a heart attack. And our mom was like, I won't live at the beach. And your daddy will not get away from these shops as long as y'all got all these shops. Y'all got to fix this. And so mama put the hammer down. We were like, okay, we got to fix something
sandal
about this.
Repair shop. Let's go.
Yeah. And so we sold all of the stores we had. We financed them for the managers of the stores that we were had in place and just set them up in business. And we went back to one location. Down the road is when Tobias came in. And then he and Lance one day came up to me and they were like, look, we want to do what y'all did when y'all were young. We want to have a chain of shoe repair shops. And so the quest was on. And in 2016, we added the Durham store for Tobias. And then a year and one day later, we added the Charlotte store for my son, Lance, in 2017. Eventually, Tobias, he just aggravated me really, really bad with constantly trying to change the way we were doing things and stuff. And I was like, look, man, I'm just kicking you to the curb where you're going to go to a cabin in the middle of nowhere. And that's just going to be the end of it.
Yeah. The idea, you know, to open up a chain was intriguing at first. And then I had to have employees and train people and manage them and all that stuff. And I was like, this is not for me. I prefer the solitude.
It's tough, man. It really is. I mean, just the idea that at the beginning, you said, we're going to make a chain of these things, you know, like that was like a set goal at the beginning. I think that's quite the opposite from most cobblers, right? They say, okay, here I am. I'm going to do the work. You know, maybe it wasn't enough to sustain a long-term business or you didn't want to, but, you know, just from like a service sense, knowing that there's people in places and they can use this kind of work.
That was kind of what my brother and I, you know, had looked at was the industry was at a point where it wanted to grow. We went into this more as a business than as a craftsman. As you mentioned, you know, most shoe repairmen, they don't go into looking to open up a chain of stores. They are craftsmen who open up their own store because, let's be honest, craftsmen are hard-headed, stubborn people to deal with, and they don't really want to take orders from somebody else. So they really just become self-employed, and that's their goal for their store. Is they want to open their store and they want to run it their way and they want to do things their way until the day they retire. My brother and I, he was the craftsman and I was a businessman. That was what our goal was when we started out, was to teach people the trade. We had a policy, and to this day, we've still not broken that policy. We don't hire anybody who knows how to do shoe repair.
Nobody.
Nobody. We've never hired anyone that was an experienced cobbler because they've already learned their own bad habits, and it's harder to break a bad habit than it is to teach a new habit. We wanted to teach people to do it our way. But we always had an open policy of allowing you to have your freedom of speech.
Yeah, I mean, you give a lot of leeway for creativity, which is awesome. You know, for me, it's the same thing. Like I'm more like your brother, where I'm more of a craftsman and I'm more into it for the art and everything than I am for the business. So our relationship ends up working out really well because you keep my head on my shoulders. You know, when I have crazy wild ideas, like I want to do this and this and this, you're like, it doesn't work. But you still listen and you still work with me on it, which has been really nice. You're not like, oh, it's my way or the highway kind of thing. And you do that with all of our employees, which is really nice. Yeah, he allows us to kind of explore our own creativity and artistic ways within the repairs. But as far as the basics go, he has some strict rules.
We have very strict rules about quality, its appearance. We developed a system early on because we were trying to develop a chain of stores and we needed a system of how to do the shoe. So this is step one, step two, step three, because people need steps to follow when they're learning. We ran next day service for almost 30 years. Since COVID, the whole world has changed and we've had to adapt to that. But in order to be able to put out quality repairs on next day service, we had to have a very rigid system, but we allow creative thought and we would sometimes adapt. We realized that even though we had certain things that we were pretty stern about, there had to be the ability to learn. Everybody has something to contribute. It panned out really good for us because in 2018, Tobias started playing with doing decorative soles. What's the point in putting bunking on the bottom of the sole and putting dye stain on the bottom of the sole? I even told him, I said, dude, that's a waste of time. You're wasting your time. You're working extra hours for nothing. Well, it turns out the consumers were moving in a direction where they were looking for that. They didn't want just the basic, good quality workhorse repair. They wanted their footwear to make a statement for them. And I wasn't paying attention to that fashion world, but he was, because I allowed him that freedom to continue and didn't say, no, you can't do that. He kept on until I saw the vision that he had. And then that's when we changed directions with our company. That's when we joined Facebook groups, got into things like that, started the Instagram, and eventually it worked into our YouTube channel.
Man, I love that. Just being able to make that personal statement with your footwear for about 1.5 solid miles on pavement, then your shoe sole looks exactly the same. But it's like, it's beautiful, right? Like there's really nothing like those kind of shoes, especially like, you know, something more modern for sure, but like an old vintage pair of Florsheims with those kind of soles. Like it's incredible to see. I've never had a pair that actually I did. I had a pair of these old, horrifically beaten, like within an inch of their life, John Lobbs double monks that my buddy just gave to me because they shouldn't have been on somebody's feet at that point, you know, got like the full deal restoration and they look brand new with the beautiful soles, and gave them to my brother because he actually like wears suits and stuff, but he appreciated them.
John Lobb's a good shoe.
Yeah, I actually remember when you did that. I remember the post about that. That was
really
cool.
Jim McFarland down in Florida did some wondrous work. I mean, it's incredible, obviously, you know, what people can do in this field and just push it. And, you know, making more and more people realize that, I was going to talk about it in the second half, but we might as well do it a bit right now. Like, how did that begin to occur? Like, when did those light bulbs start to go off for you that you realized that people wanted it? And so, you know, you got to provide it and get good at it and all that. And then turn around and kind of say, this is what we do. If you want this, come here. Like, what were those moments like with that shift?
It really kind of just started with me joining a Facebook group of a bunch of cobblers internationally. It was the first time I learned that there were contests in shoe repair. So people were posting some of their contest entries and everything. And it was work I've just never seen before in my life. I was like, wow, this is, you know, this is beyond repair. This is art. I reached out to a couple of them and I said, hey, is this something that you guys, you know, offer to your customers? And they said, no, it was just for the show. And there were a couple of guys that were offering it, but I, for the life of me, could not sell it at the front counter. You know, no one wanted that. Like you said, it's wearable art, you know, one or two wears and it's gone. So I started to do it for free, just for my own pleasure, just so I could take pictures of it and I could post it on my Yelp page and my Google page. And I figured if I took good enough pictures of it, then people would see that and then come in and ask him for it. And they did. That's when it took off. And once they started asking for it, I knew I could start charging for it.
That's really cool. So what kind of stuff is coming into the cabin? And then is that drastically different than what people are walking in with and like the type of repairs that people need? Like, is there a very, very firm line between what's going on with kind of the two sides of the business?
You know, it's not wildly different. We've taken one category of shoe repair and put it on in our mail in business. So basic shoe repair, you got everything. You're fixing handbags, stitch jobs, whatever comes in the door. You know, if you can get it on your machine, you'll fix it and you'll take it in. Whereas, you know, we're limiting a little bit more to what we're taking in online and getting mailed in. Mostly Goodyear welted shoes and stuff like that, something that we can flow with and work into our process a little bit easier. But yeah, because of that, you know, it's become a lot more like higher end stuff, a lot more boots and nicer shoes and everything. You know, just looking through the workloads between what I have in my cabin and what we have in our brick and mortar stores, it is considerably different. Yes.
We've kind of tailored the cabin work as well. Like he mentioned with the website, the way we designed it is to focus on as much customization type work as possible. Then we still have the brick and mortar stores and all the employees that do. So we do offer things on our website that's more standard shoe repair, but we don't necessarily send that to the cabin.
I gotta say, guys, the site is fantastic. Like, I don't think that there's a better one out there in terms of somebody coming to a site. I mean, a lot of cobbler shops don't have one at all, but they come there and they say, all right, I need my shoes fixed. And then it's all laid out there. The ways you can go, obviously you can push that in any sort of direction, you know, which I imagine that you have conversations with customers and, you know, kind of show them what's possible. But yeah, just in terms of, again, like coming back to this idea of shoe repair as this essential service and then being able to add creativity and beauty to it, you can grasp it all very, very quickly from your website. I think it's just exceptional, honestly, and just like a very, very high quality way of instructing and educating people on the core stuff, but then also the possibilities of it. I mean, just a little bit of praise. I think it's great.
Thank you. Yeah, we have a lot of plans to build it out even further as far as the education portion goes. So, you know, when we're trying to sell you a different type of welt, you know, you should be able to understand what we're trying to sell you between a storm welt and a split welt. And we want the real easy visuals and everything. And one of the things that Tony came up with and has kept true to is allowing people the transparency of what we're charging for. He'll break it down for you. He used to send text messages with a complete breakdown, you know, how much the heel bases were, how much the welting was, how much this was. And that way people can kind of pick and choose what they can afford, what they want, and how far they want to go with it without just getting a price point and saying, hey, no, I'm not going to put that into my boots. So it's really nice. And yeah, the website's helped us out a lot with that, where people can kind of just go there first and answer a lot of their own questions before even contacting us.
It's great. Look, let's take a quick break and we'll be right back with Tony and Toby. All right, gents. I don't know if you knew this was coming, but it's time for Gen Facts. If you somehow didn't know, Jen works at Standard & Strange and is an expert at customer service, looking just cool always. I don't know how he does it. And pranking the shit out of everybody he meets. So once again, today Jen has given us three facts, only one of which is true, and two of which are damn dirty lies. I'll read all three, and your job, gentlemen, is to determine the true Jen fact, which we'll do at the end of the episode. Also, we've never done this before, but we're going to give you the exact same Gen facts we gave Jim McFarlane 2 years ago, almost to the day. One, because I'm pretty sure he got them wrong, and so this is a chance for overall cobbler redemption. And two, these are some of my favorite Gen facts ever. You guys ready?
Okay.
Ready.
Gen fact number one, a load of cobblers, and variants such as what a load of cobblers or just cobblers is British Cockney slang for what nonsense. Somehow, some way, it evolved in the 1960s, growing from cobbler's alls, which rhymed with balls, which those prim and proper Cockneys, of course, wanted to avoid saying. What a load of cobblers. Gen fact number two, the Guinness record for the largest number of shoes repaired in a single day by a single person is held by Gregor Nielsen, Norwegian cobbler who, over the course of 23 hours, with a surprisingly leisurely lunch break in the middle, repaired 76 unique issues on 228 pairs of shoes. Big day. Gen fact number three, the world's first famous cobbler was a man by the name of Cord Wainwright, who veered off from the family tradition of wagon making to open England's most renowned shoe repair business of the 17th century in Covent Garden, London. After beginning as the official royal shoe repair specialist, King James II eventually named Wainwright his full-time shoemaker, ushering into the lexicon the term cordwainer for the profession of shoemaking. These are good ones. Don't answer now, though. We'll reveal the true Gen fact at the end of the episode. Stay tuned. Let's get back to the ShoeCast. All right, we're back with Tony and Tobias of Wyatt and Dagg Cobbler Company in North Carolina. All right, so let's kind of get to the big one that we alluded to earlier. But we all know in the most obvious way number of stores, the cobbling trade is, it's declining in that way. These are kind of old numbers, but from that episode with Jim a couple years ago, he had seen the number of shops in the U.S. have a bit of a drop from about 120,000 in 1928, different world, but still, to around 3,500 in what would have been 2022. And I understand it's even less now. In other ways, there's everything that we've been talking about, right? This growth of kind of specialty cobbling. And you guys are expanding and contracting and re-expanding in terms of just the number of stores and understanding, you know, how many people and shoes and bags, et cetera, there are to service in any given place. But I don't know, like, where are you at on all of this? How do you feel that these headwinds are blowing probably in various directions in terms of this whole industry going forward for the next 5, 10, 50 years?
This is my understanding of the history of shoe repair. In World War II, it was mandatory that you got your shoes fixed because they weren't making new shoes.
For civilians, yeah, because it was all going to military production.
I was born in the early 60s. It's funny, but my brother and I are 4.5 years apart in age. And he remembers as a child being taken to the shoe shop to get things fixed. Whereas I have no memory of ever being in a shoe shop until I was an adult. My generation didn't grow up knowing as much about shoe repair as my brother's generation with just a 4-year gap. When we were starting our business back in the 90s, we took this into consideration. An article came out in the SSIA magazine. They had done a survey throughout the United States, and a good shoe repair town was only 2% of the population was getting their shoes repaired at that time. This was in 1990. Of the people that were interviewed, 60% who had never heard of shoe repair or had never used shoe repair said they thought that was a great idea and they would do it if they knew where to go and what to ask for. Wyatt and Dad's policy became, instead of trying to grow our business on the 2% people, we decided to go after the 98%.
Good math.
That 60% said was a good idea if they knew where to go and what to ask for. Our strategy for advertisement was never to compete with another shop. We don't need to. There's so many people out there who would love to get their shoes fixed if they knew where to go and what to ask for. We didn't have to fight over that 2%. Our advertising was always, hey, this is what can be done. And by the way, here's our address. The good side of that is in Winston-Salem, when we were growing, other shops in town started growing also from our advertisements because people were too lazy to drive 20 miles to us when they could drive 5 miles to another shop. And they asked the guy, hey, do you do this? And the guy would go, yeah, I can do that service also. And so it just kind of helped everybody grow. And that kind of fed me in a way that I really enjoyed that part of my job. So if you notice on our YouTube channel, you know, I try to do Tony Goes a Cobbling where I talk about other shops. If you follow any of our social media, you'll see where we're constantly recommending other shops that are local because this industry needs to survive. And with it having so few shops, if somebody is local to a good shop, I would rather they go to them than to mail it into us. Even though I enjoy the money and the business, I want the industry to survive as well. And then we also have customers who, you know, because of this, they'll go and establish that relationship with a local shop for their standard needs, but that shop doesn't offer the level of customization that we do. So they still send us their custom work. So that's a really good perk about that aspect as well.
Man, I mean, that's vision, right? That's like the big picture and understanding it. And not everybody does in any industry. We're definitely going to talk about kind of the more modern marketing, the YouTube, et cetera, that you guys do. I'm really interested though to hear, you know, that survey came out 35 years ago that you mentioned, and you said, okay, you know, this gives me an idea of how to approach this. What did those ads look like in 1990 and 1998? What were you putting out there that created this burst of knowledge and interest in shoe repair?
Well, recycling was very big in the 90s, late 80s and the 90s. So
Captain Planet.
Yeah, those of you who have seen our logo on the back of our shirts now, you know it's about our professional cobblers and this and that. Well, we put a logo out that was recycle, resell, and save. So you're saving the product and you're saving money by recycling and reselling your shoes. That was also when Vibram was really starting to take over the market with their marketing, and people were starting to get the name brand Vibram. So we switched over to Vibram products and we advertised those Vibram products. We were doing television commercials.
Will you put those on your YouTube?
If we can get them. The problem is trying to get them transferred over. I think we've got one that has been digitized. It's really cool. All three of our sons, my brother, he has two boys and I have one. All three of our sons were in the commercial. It was really cool. But the youngest one, Vibram, made him a cape and custom made him a t-shirt with the Vibram logo to fit him. It shows a customer throwing his shoes away. He popped out of the trash can and has the shoes in his hand and says, "Don't throw these away." And he's called Vibram Man. It says Vibram Man saves the day, you know, at the end of the, thing.
He's like six.
Yeah, he was like four or five. Yeah. And his older brother was in a business suit and he was driving my 94 Mustang. And he gets out and he goes, "Man, these shoes are killing me." And he gets out and he goes in. And my son, Lance, was waiting behind the counter. And then it shows him putting the Vibram soles on the shoe and hammering it down and everything. He actually did a really good job. I mean, he nailed centering the sole and everything. It looks like he's been doing it forever. And it was his first go because it had glue on it and everything when he stuck it. So it was a really cool commercial. And we just kind of fed off of that for a little while. We did a few things with Vibram Man. Vibram has a sole called Gum Light, which is a cushion sole that was more durable.
It's a great sole.
Yeah, than the old fashioned EVA soles. One of my employees had a Husky that was used to carrying a backpack. And so we made a pack and hung soles off of him. And so that was Vibram Man's sidekick. Gumlight was the dog's nickname. You know, we just tried to be creative back then and stuff like that to attract attention to the industry. Eventually, it worked out real well. The shops in town with us hit me up and they're like, "Man, we ought to go in together." And we actually had a billboard in town that just advertised shoe repair. You know, nobody's name was mentioned because they learned through, you know, my advertising how that had grown their business that, hey, we don't really have to compete. So we just didn't. We just advertised shoe repair. And it'd be great to see the industry go back in that direction to help build it back up.
Man, you got to get these things up. You have to.
I've been working for this company for 12 years and I still haven't seen that commercial. So,
all right, we'll do a big unveiling party on the internet, which we'll talk about right now. So, I mean, it seems like today to be one of D Cobblers getting mail in stuff and having this business that's growing, at least from that perspective, but probably from a more basic one as well, you got to have all the social stuff, right? And the video and the YouTube channel, et cetera. And you guys do in a very real way. What was it like building that out? And do you see that purpose having changed at all from some of the things that you were maybe doing in the 90s? Or is it actually similar and it's just a different format, different platform?
We're still using a very similar strategy. I'll let Tobias chime in and tell you about how he completely converted. He won't mention this part, so I'm going to, but he completely converted a shop in Durham. The people came in and wanted the bare minimum. They wanted the cheapest thing you could get them, and they wanted it as fast as you could get it. Yesterday wasn't fast enough for them, and $3 was too much, was the mentality of this shop. Over the course of the next 2 years, he over doubled their best year within his first year of running the shop with his strategy. And that opened my eyes to how social media can be a very new and good venue for advertising. So once he showed me that path, I just adapted our old marketing type strategy to the new format that he was showing me.
For me, it was more so just a sense of transparency, you know, and that's one thing that social media offers and allows, you know, like if I'm going to be taking a picture, especially with these new cameras on these phones and stuff like that, if I'm going to be taking a picture of my work, you're going to see every detail and all that stuff. So
for me, I really wanted to kind of show that, you know, I wanted people to really be able to vet me before they even walked in my door. To start off with, it was a Google search, you know, you had to kind of see what your business looked like from, you know, the customer's eyes. You know, what are they going to do first? They're going to Google shoe repair near me. And so if my page pops up and I don't have any kind of information, you know, you're probably not going to look. But if my page pops up and I got tons of pictures and examples of my work and reviews and all this other stuff, then people will probably gravitate more towards that. And they did. It was just a matter of transparency. And we do the same thing with our YouTube. We want to show you guys just exactly like down to the stitch, how we, you know, do these builds and everything so that, you know, before you even reach out to us, or we do it a certain way. So yeah, it was mostly just adding pictures so that people can kind of vet my work. I had samples all over my store so people can come in and see and feel and touch and really just not even question that I'm going to do a proper job on their repairs.
That's pretty cool. I mean, I feel like the approach that you guys have and have had the whole time of, it's not just about us and the billboard and doing videos, visiting other shops. It's fantastic. I feel like this episode alone can create that kind of rising tide, I think, like help people in all localities just understand things that have been successful. You know, the Google thing and the Yelp page, that's simple. Making videos and building out a studio in the back of the shop, and I mean, just shooting them and cutting them and editing them. Talent, which obviously the word to define the two of you in all ways, that's not something that everybody can do or do well or do consistently. But some of this simpler stuff is attainable, like really for all, if you just take the time and think about it and put in a little effort. So yeah, I mean, I think that everything that we just talked about is hugely useful. This industry, yeah, it only works if people can get their shoes repaired and want to get their shoes repaired. And the mail-in and the cabin is only going to be a slice of it. And for most businesses, it's going to be zero part of it. It's the simpler stuff in that 98% of people that, you know, is hopefully grown to 96% of people who don't realize that they can even fix their shoes. So good work.
The thing about the YouTube and even the social media like Instagram and Facebook, not everybody in the industry is going to go in that direction. But Tobias's approach to increase his shop and really lift up the status of his store in his customers' eyes, and then people quit even asking how much something costs, they started coming in going, this is what I want. I saw this and that's what I want. We obviously have to offer a fair price for what our trade is and what things are. So, you know, they assumed that we were going to be as honest about that as we were about our work, which, you know, we do our best to be honest about is, you know, everything in life. So for other shops, just something as simple as what he did, take pictures of your work, post it on your Yelp page and your Google page. It's free. Man, I spent thousands every month of dollars back in the 90s trying to grow our business because we didn't have these venues. You had to have a big ad in the Yellow Pages, commercials. You had to have an ad for everything. Everything costs money. Nowadays, you don't have to spend any money to advertise your shop. You have to spend your time. Your time is money, some people would argue, but hey, you know, you can spend your time sitting around twiddling your thumbs, wondering if your business is going to make it, or you can make your business make it by putting a little extra time in. Is that TV show really that important that night? You know, does it really matter compared to the success of your business?
I will throw in here one cost. It'll be cost that covers you for at least a couple of years. Just get that new phone, right? Get a phone that has just an exceptional camera these days and can capture the work and the detail, like you mentioned, Toby, but also just take a really good, appealing picture with minimal effort.
You know, it goes beyond the pictures as well. You know, you can post pretty pictures to your Yelp and Google and everything, but, you know, it also, I think a big part of what I did in my shop was just the appearance of when you walk in the door as well. And I made sure my shop was clean and tidy, because that's going to automatically, people think that my work's going to be clean and tidy. And it was very, very important to me, just like any marketing. You know, there's a brand called Michael Kors that everyone's familiar with, and their quality is subpar. But people, they see it just like a lot of these brand names, you know, they'll be like, but, you know, this is a Michael Kors. Like, why is it? Why can't I fix this? You know, even though it's made out of plastic, you know, I would think like, you know, why are these people buying this stuff? And you go to a Michael Kors store and it is gorgeous. Like every single item has its own lit up little shelf and it's clean and it's just attractive. And so you think you're getting high quality product. And the same goes for your shop. You know, if you keep it clean, keep it nice and keep it good looking, when people walk in the door, they're going to know that you mean business. I've been in a countless of shoe repair shops where, you know, there's maybe a pathway between all the junk that they have lying around and the dust that's covered on everything. And because they've been sitting there cobbling, you know, for 30 years and focusing more on the work than they are on their appearance. And it goes a long way when you have an image. It's something that we preach a lot on forums, on shoe repair forums and everything, is create that image of what you're trying to market and produce, and people will respond positively to it.
It's not the first time we've heard that one from people who are really successful at this. No surprise, right? Like Jim and Steve Dudaklian at Beto's. His name is not Beto. And Justin from the SSIA. I don't know. I'm not the tidiest person in the world. I'm sitting in my studio that you guys can see, that we do some video stuff. So like I'm fooling you, maybe. But like there's, I don't know, popcorn on the floor around me. But when it's time to make a YouTube video, like let's make it look pretty decent at least, right? And the mess can be kind of behind the scenes. I mean, this is the vision of the old, dusty, dirty cobbler shop. Like, I'm not going to lie. For me, at least, there is a charm to it. I mean, like an old bootmaking workshop. Like, I've been in some incredible ones. And you're like, yeah, I mean, maybe like sweep the floor, but like, don't change this place. Like, there's such rich history baked into it. But I'm also not like the normal person. I appreciate that for my own reasons, and I'm like neck deep in this whole industry and its history and the craft and everything.
That's a good point about you like the rusticness and the history. If you notice, we're in a 120-year-old cabin is our trademark branding style that we're using.
Yeah, and about 90% of my decorations in that cabin are antique boot shoe stuff.
So we're feeding on what you like. We just don't leave the trash laying on the floor, you know, keep it clean, get rid of the bad side of it, and actually use the good side to create your image.
It goes as far as even your process, you know, like customers don't want to see their John Lobs thrown into a bin with a bunch of other shoes on top of them. You know what I mean? So those things matter too. So, you know, if you come into a shop and you see all the shoes are packaged neatly and all that stuff, you know, you have a trust that this cobbler is going to take care of your stuff. And I think that's very important.
The phone you mentioned is very important investment, because we post pictures and we're active in several different types of social media, even with that are restricted to just cobblers. We talk to them about promoting and they go, yeah, but you guys have such a high level of this and that. And I tell them, I say, our pictures are taken on an iPhone. And they're like, what? We thought you had like a several $1,000 camera and a studio that you were doing it. I'm like, no, Tobias takes the pictures near a window for lighting,
which is important.
Yeah. And he uses his iPhone for the pictures, and that's it. The sad thing about our industry is I know several extremely talented cobblers. They do beautiful work, and some of them have part-time jobs just to make ends meet. Why? In this day and time, when there's so few shops, why are you struggling? But I try to talk to them about going in and doing these things, and they don't have time for that, or they don't want to do that, or that's just not their thing. So our industry, it's, you mentioned earlier about how we had so many shops and we lost so many shops over the course of time. How did that happen in our industry? Is it a bad job to have? Absolutely not. This is a fantastic trade to get to know and to learn. Here's kind of my take on the industry and how it went about. In the 50s, the government started pushing the agenda, get a college education. If you want the country to go where it needs to go, then you need to get a college education. So these tradesmen who were raising their families to be shoe repairmen, they were multi-generational shoe repairmen themselves, you know, because they had been passed down from father to son, father to son, father to daughter throughout time. they were told the best thing you can do for your family is send them to college. So they sent their kids to college, and their kids became doctors and lawyers. So they didn't get to pass it down. So when did this happen? In the 50s is when the marketing started. So that means in the 80s, all the kids were going to college, and the craftsmen didn't have anybody to hand it down to. So what I saw when I got in the industry in the 90s, in the early 90s, was the trade was being purchased, and it had been for a few years. Well, you had all these craftsmen who were now at retiring age, and they had no children to pass their business down to. So they were selling their business for basically 50% of a year's volume. So if they did $50,000, you could buy the business for $25,000. So when people wonder why there are shops that do bad work, it's because of this. This brought in the bad work that is plaguing our industry right now. They weren't really trained how to do the job properly. Some people learn really quickly, but you know, some people don't, because there's never been a lack of business. In all of our shops that we own, they all grew, they all doubled. They all were very successful. There was never a lack of business why any of them were not our own. We didn't close any down for those reasons. In the 90s, these businesses were being bought. Those people struggled along, but made them successful and stayed in business. And now they're at a retirement age. And we started losing shops right and left over the past 10 years pre-COVID. And then COVID, you know, shut down. It just took out a lot of color, because most shops, like we mentioned earlier, are people who are not business people. They're just self-employed people. So they were not prepared for being shut down for several months. And even if they could have gotten the PPP loans, they didn't know how to go about getting that kind of stuff done. And it took out a big portion of our trade. The consumer side of things is now people are more interested in craftsmanship, handmade things. Like you just mentioned, you want that history. You want that reason to buy that thing. You want that type of stuff. And our customers are wanting that for their footwear. They're wanting that craftsmanship, and they got nobody to go to. It takes very little effort to build a business in our industry with, you know, a minimal amount of marketing that just costs you some time. But our trade is a great trade because, you know, if they'll learn the trade, they can get in and put a little bit of business sense behind it, and they can be very, very successful. And now there's also a new wave in our industry, which is customization. People are sending us brand new boots and brand new shoes and wanting them customized completely. They've never even worn them. Some people, it's an order from our local shoe stores and have them delivered to our shop, so they never even tried them on or saw them. People have customized cars forever. I mean, I remember my dad talking about him customizing cars back in the 40s. So, you know, that's been going on a really long time. And now people are getting into that with their footwear. And if these shops would just embrace the new waves that are coming through, because every industry has waves and they constantly change. And so you got to be ready to move with the new wave and not hold on to the old ways too long, or it stifles your business. So, you know, it's a great industry for young people to get out there and to take the time to learn. And it's very rewarding. Everybody I know that is in the industry loves it. So, you know, it's a lot of fun.
On that note, you guys made a video about attending the SSIA convention last year. I'm actually going to go this year. What was that like? What happened? What's the value of a convention where all these cobblers from across the country come together for a couple of days?
So it was my first convention. It was a blast. It was really cool. You get all the vendors for all the, you know, materials and stuff that we use every day. You get to see new products that they've developed and come out with. And, you know, similar to what you guys put on with boot camp, but, you know, very cobbler and repair specific, new machines and stuff. It was really cool. But just being in the community of like-minded people was just awesome. Sharing stories, customer stories and tips and tricks. And it was something else. And I'm excited to go again this year.
Nice. I'll see you guys there. And I guess, Tony, I don't think I saw you last year. I saw Tobias for like a minute. It was a crazy couple of days, but thank you so much for coming to our boot camp event last year in Brooklyn. It really means a ton. We're doing it again, of course. And we want to do it better and better. So how do we do that? What do you guys want to see there? What do you think people would want to see there?
it's hard for me to criticize anything that went on. I thought it was a very, very good show. I enjoyed every minute there. It was educational. You know, the manufacturer people, representatives were at each of their booths. And that's probably why you didn't see me, because I was just talking to everybody I could to learn everything I could about their particular brand and why they did it and where they were from. And I really don't know how to tell you to improve on what you did, because you guys really put together a good show. It was great.
Thank you for all that and for coming. And we want to grow it. We want to just expand the scope of it, but also what it means, what people can learn and take away from community aspects. And frankly, like, bring in the repair side is a big thing that we're working on. I had a call with the SSIA board earlier this week, you know, figuring some things out from that perspective too, which I think speaks to the footwear itself and why it's valuable and why one might want to purchase it, because it can be repaired and it can live for a very long time, but also just like the beauty itself of the work and that side of the craftsmanship. And that's definitely something that we're going to be working on for the next 8 months here.
Yeah, I'm with Tony. You guys put on a great show. I really don't know how to improve it. I do like the idea of, you know, maybe something a little bit more educational, like, you know, these boots broken down and like the different parts of it. So that way you can kind of educate the customer maybe on what they're buying. So that way when they're going from booth to booth and seeing these boots, they can go with the knowledge of what they're looking at. And yeah, as far as the shoe repair side of that goes, you know, maybe, you know, allowing to educate why you buy recraftable boots in the first place, their ability to be resold and recrafted and reused and passed on. And, or even like we were talking about earlier, being customized to your likings, or like Tony was saying, beyond repair as well. We also can meet your needs if you have special needs and everything too for your feet, and you need your footwear adjusted for, you know, maybe your left foot's a lot wider than your right foot. Maybe we can give you a little bit more room in that left boot while we recraft it. You know, those kind of things, you know, I think are very important beyond just really fancy, awesome looking boots.
All right, we'll do it. I think we'll probably have beer again too. It seemed to
be beer. It was a good ingredient. Yeah, of the show. Yeah. It didn't seem to hurt anyone's feelings.
No, it didn't. I think it was appropriately administered.
I like the hands-on aspect that you guys did.
There's going to be a lot more of that. And that was just one idea. Crown, you know, / E. Woodford was like, we're just going to bring our whole workshop over here. And also, we're going to let people do it. It was like, okay, great. And, you know, the opportunities for that, it was about 2 minutes before 2 days worth of being able to hand-stitch the welt onto those shoes was gone, right? Like, so that's something that we're really going to be focused on, and opportunities for people to take classes, maybe make a very simple pair of shoes, but different kinds of leather working, just kind of getting your hands dirty, making something, right? Like understanding what it feels like to actually create something with proper guidance in a short period of time. And then, yeah, think about what that means, obviously, for shoes and boots.
I was going to say, a couple of guys that took that class, that inseaming class, whatever, they came to me and they told me, they're like, this is really difficult. Like, yeah. And so it was a little bit easier for us to justify the price that we have for hand sewing so many welts. It's a tough job.
Yeah, I think that's a huge part of it. Like, one, you feel like you kind of get it better personally and you understand what's going on inside of the shoe that like looks simple, but really isn't. But yeah, just like, okay, man, somebody's doing this over and over and over and over. Well, yeah, that should probably have value that one has to pay for. It creates this complete justification that I think the ones who took that workshop, they were already really hardcore. They signed up in the first 2 minutes. They're like, yeah, here we go. Core people of this community who are out there furthering it for others. I mean, you take a person off the street and you do that, like their whole life is going to be changed, I think. But this is great. Thank you guys. We need all this feedback, and we're going to tune this sucker up. And thank you so much for coming. It meant a ton.
Yeah. And I hopefully can make it again this year.
October 12th and 13th. You can do it. All right. Should we do these Gen Facts?
Let's do the Gen Facts.
Now, nobody listened to the gym episode, did they?
Oh, I most definitely did. I'm an avid listener.
I listened to that one as well, but I don't remember his answers or have any clue as to which one's which, all of that.
All right. So maybe these are just for Tony then.
That's right.
All right. To refresh, Gen Fact number one, what a load of cobblers means, I don't agree with this at all, absolute nonsense. Gen Fact number two, Gregor Nielsen repaired 228 pairs of shoes in one day, probably had Norwegian brown cheese for lunch. Gen Fact number three, famed British shoe repairman Cord Wainwright is where we got the term cordwainer from. What do you think, Tony? Only one of these is true, remember.
I'm thinking the middle one.
We're going Gregor Nielsen. Do you think you could beat him? 23 hours straight, man.
That's a long time to be working and stuff, but yeah.
We need to know the variables here. Like, what were the 76 problems that the guy did? You know, is it all like one little thing or full resource? It's totally different.
I'm pretty sure that he has it up on his YouTube channel. Back, it's an old video from the 17th century, which means that you guys can get those commercials up. No, I don't know. But Tony's going with number two. Let's check this out.
My brother did, he did 25 pairs of full soles and heels in one day, and that was just a 12-hour day. So I think the guy could have done that many repairs if they were some of smaller things and stuff like that.
Let's see. Actually, I already know the answer, but I'm still opening up this fake envelope. Oh, Tony, you got two, man. It's number one.
Wow.
What a load of cobblers actually means. Nonsense. Absolute nonsense. Not fair at all.
I've been using that ever since I heard that.
Have you?
That episode, yeah.
It's actually pretty great. Huge thanks to Stern and Strange for sponsoring this episode. They are also not a load of cobblers. Support the ShoeCast by joining the bustling and insanely helpful and honestly just damn fun Stitchdown Premium community in Discord. More info on stitchdown.com. Make sure you're getting yourself to Industry City, Brooklyn this October 12th and 13th, 2024 for Stitchdown's Bootcamp 2, celebration of shoemaking, and the ultimate community gathering. But most of all, huge thanks to Tony and Toby for coming on the ShoeCast today. This was a blast. And just the perspective that you guys offered on this whole industry and just how to have success in it, which is really by giving customers what they want and letting them know that it's possible. It's huge. So yeah, appreciated by me, but you know, hopefully a ton of people who listen to this and just think about how to do it all the right way.
It's been great talking with you, and thank you for inviting us on your show.
Yeah, we enjoyed it. This was a lot of fun.
All right. I'm going to hassle you guys about making some videos together. We've been talking a little bit in the background, but hopefully we put our heads together on that soon and people get to see it. Love what you're doing. All right. That's it for this week. Take care of your shoes. We'll see you next time.